From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 21st of April, these are our main stories. We get the latest from Sudan, where fighting continues with no ceasefire in sight. Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab resigns from government a day after a report investigating bullying allegations against him was released. Also in this podcast, as British Vogue dedicates the latest issue to people with disabilities, we speak to the editor.
I just want it to be easy to talk about it. I want people to be able to talk about it in offices. I mean, a lot of your colleagues will have disabilities, and maybe now, you know, they can share it and not be shy about it.
We begin this podcast in Sudan, where there is no let-up in the violence, with shelling and gunfire continuing throughout the night. It comes as diplomatic pressure is being stepped up to end the fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces. Well, earlier this morning, the RSF agreed to a three-day pause in the fighting on humanitarian grounds, but as of yet, there's no comment from the army. At least 300 people have been killed and many have been trapped in their homes for days. Dalia Abdul-Monium is in the capital Khartoum and ventured outside for the first time in almost a week ahead of the upcoming Eid holiday.
No one is celebrating. What these men have done to us, I don't think there's no word to describe the ramifications of what they've done. And I don't know how we as a people or as a country can recover.
While many people are trapped, some are managing to flee. The UN's refugee agency estimates that up to 20,000 people have crossed the border into neighbouring Chad since the violence erupted, the majority of whom have been women and children. Laura Locastro is the UNHCR's representative there.
The most likely scenario envisages the arrival of many more. This is quite worrisome because already we have in Chad about 400,000 refugees from Sudan, and it's already a very underfunded operation. So we are very worried by the massive arrival of more refugees because we will not have any means to support them without additional international support.
I got more on all this from our Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding.
This morning I've been on the phone in touch with four or five people in Khartoum. Different parts of the city all report heavy fighting. Apparently there's some huge explosions in the city centre in the middle of the night as well. It's interesting though that the US State Department is giving a slightly more positive spin, talking about an earlier ceasefire kind of holding and looking to see if this three-day ceasefire that the paramilitary rapid support group have at least said that they might sign up to, and indeed said began this morning, that they think that could be extended. No response yet, though, from the Sudanese leadership, the leadership of the army. General Al-Burhan, as you mentioned earlier, in a statement, a pre-recorded statement, not mentioning anything about a ceasefire, but again repeating his promise of a need for a transition to civilian rule at some point.
So the United Nations, the US and other regional powers are all pushing for a ceasefire, but there seems to be so much resistance. One imagines there are military reasons for this from both sides.
Yes, I mean, there's clearly an opportunity here, particularly over this holiday weekend, for both sides to pull back, a pause that could then be used by diplomats perhaps to build up some momentum towards negotiations. But on the ground, it seems clear that these two sides are locked in a do-or-die battle for survival and expecting one side or the other to emerge victorious, and at this stage no indication that longer term, even though we've had this offer of a three-day ceasefire over the holidays by the paramilitary, no indication that they are prepared to talk more substantively about the integration of the paramilitary into the army, which is at the root of the current power struggle.
Andrew Harding. News now of a government resignation here in the UK. The Deputy Prime Minister, Dominic Raab, has stepped down following an investigation into bullying claims against him. In a letter posted on his Twitter account, Mr. Raab said he was resigning, but noted that all but two of the allegations against him were dismissed. Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, told me more about the content of his resignation letter.
It's extraordinary. I've never quite seen a resignation letter like it, because he says, I'm resigning, but then adds, really, I've done nothing wrong, and this whole investigation, the way it's carried out, is going to badly affect the way government is done. He describes it as Kafkaesque, because he says the bar for bullying has been set too low, and that basically means that ministers who are elected, you know, can't really get on the case of the permanent bureaucracy, the civil service, to get on and do what the government wants them to do. That's his basic defence.
And Rob, what's been the reaction from his boss or former boss, the Prime Minister?
The first thing I should say before I get on to that, and don't worry, I will, Nick, is that the report does contain bits which are very, very damning. I mean, it does paint a picture of a man who can get very angry when he doesn't get his own way. What has Mr. Sunak said? Well, he's tried to say as little as possible to sort of praise Mr. Raab, and has been ever so slightly sort of critical of the process himself, not this particular investigation, but maybe implying, hinting that the government needs to look at how one does deal with these accusations of bullying.
Now, when he was Foreign Secretary, Mr. Raab came under a lot of criticism for how he reacted to the Taliban taking over in Afghanistan. So I suppose one might say he won't be massively missed by the government. Do you think it's going to have a negative impact on the government still?
Well, it's not great for the government. I mean, I think one shouldn't overstate it and one shouldn't understate it. One shouldn't overstate it in that Dominic Raab is perhaps not the best known politician in Britain, and you can't help thinking that the people of Britain are going to be more worried about, you know, the issues that people all over the world are worried about, inflation and the sort of strain on government services. But it's not good in the sense that Rishi Sunak had wanted to have a nice period of sort of calm, stable government after the turbulence of the Truss and Johnson years. And again, I think what this does do is sort of add to that rather negative impression of the Conservative Party, opinion polling showing that an awful lot of people, you know, do take a pretty dim view of the governing Conservatives these days.
That was Rob Watson. Gunmen in South Africa have shot dead 10 members of the same family during an attack at their home outside Pietermaritzburg. The motive for the killings is not yet clear. South Africa's murder rate recently climbed to its highest level in two decades. Grant Ferret reports.
Police were called to the house in the township of Imbali by neighbours who heard shooting in the early hours of the morning during one of South Africa's frequent power cuts. At least two attackers are thought to have gone from room to room, shooting people in their beds. Seven of those who died were women. The police minister, Bheki Tele, told reporters at the scene that one of the suspected gunmen was shot dead by police a few hours later, a short distance away.
As they saw the police, they exchanged fire with the police. Police shot back and killed one, injured one, was arrested. But the person that has died, it looks like it is linked to too many crime scenes, especially murder around here.
South Africa has a long history of violent crime, but the murder rate has soared in the past year. 15 people were shot dead in a bar in Soweto last July, and earlier this year, 8 were killed at a birthday party in the south of the country. The government's many critics accuse it of having no plan to deal with what the police minister himself has admitted is a serious problem with guns.
Grant Ferret. There is a cocaine crisis in Europe. Law enforcement agencies in Europe have told the BBC amid a surge in production of the drug. Production has actually increased by a third in just 1 year after a slowdown during the pandemic. In the most recent discovery, authorities in the UK seized more than a tonne of cocaine found floating off the south coast. Drug smugglers are even using submarines to bring millions of dollars worth of the drug into the continent from South America. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beeks sent this report.
Well, this is a piece of history in the murky story of global drugs trafficking, because I'm looking at the first submarine known to have been used to bring cocaine from South America to Europe. It's homemade. If you clamber down inside the submarine, this is the world in which the men live for 27 days. You can imagine just how claustrophobic and cramped it was down here. The heat coming from the engine, the noise as well. And in terms of the controls, they're extremely primitive. The steering wheel, just a few basic dials. And for all this time, they had very little in the way of food, just cans of sardines, some energy bars, not much else really. Apart, of course, from the 3 tons of cocaine that they'd packed away in the front, which had a street value of more than £100 million. The voyage in late 2019 ended in failure off the coast of Galicia, northwest Spain. The drugs were confiscated, the 3 crew jailed, and the narco sub now languishes in the car park of the National Police Academy near the capital Madrid. But this is no rotting relic of a bygone battle. It's a symbol of a secretly growing phenomenon. Last month, along the same stretch of coast, Spanish police found a second submarine. But the cargo was long gone.
Estamos en una crisis de cocaína.
Antonio Martínez Duarte is the chief commissioner of the narco brigade in the Spanish National Police.
Son muy difíciles de detectar.
They are very hard to detect. In fact, in more than 20 years of traffickers using submarines to reach Africa and Europe, these two are the first we've seized.
In fact, it's thought more than 100 homemade submarines have been launched towards Europe. And officers suspect somewhere in the Atlantic, off the Canary Islands or the Azores, is a mass graveyard of narco subs, deliberately sunk after their cargo had been successfully unloaded. But it's in Belgium where the greatest amount of cocaine is being seized, here at the port of Antwerp. More than 100 tons were intercepted in 2022, so much they didn't have enough incinerators to destroy it. Huge quantities are getting through, though. The head of Belgian customs told us they were facing a tsunami and would never win this war. And Michel Claes, one of Belgium's top investigating judges, believes the cocaine industry is now out of control.
It makes an absolute fortune for those we call narco-traffickers. With money laundering and corruption, which is now limitless in terms of the sums that can be offered to dockers, police officers and other people, how do you want us to have any control on criminal organizations? It's over.
Just this week, Italian police found 400 million euros worth of cocaine bobbing off the Sicilian coast, one of the country's biggest ever single seizures. The United Nations is warning that international gangs are working together closer than ever and are now looking to expand into Africa and into Asia. Europe's cocaine crisis is widening and deepening.
That was Nick Beak. Coming up,
my sources are saying there was inside help, but even that doesn't make sense to people that I've spoken with who work in this industry, who know this industry, who understand what normally goes into this sort of thing.
The $15 million gold heist at Toronto Airport.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments pro against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now to China, where a group of student volunteers at Huazhong University of Science and Technology have been using artificial intelligence to help restore photographs of missing children. And it's been a success. By passing the photos on to the families of those missing and police, 9 children have been safely returned home since the project began in 2020. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, spoke to Harry Bly.
This project has been running since 2020, and it was the brainchild of a PhD student called Sheng Jianzhong at the Huazhong Science and Technology University. And as part of his work anyway, he specializes in software, so he's been doing a lot of work with AI. And it occurred to him back in 2020 that he was seeing lots of pictures of missing children online that were very blurry. And he thought that it would be a good idea to use AI technology to be able to restore pictures of missing children, make them appear less blurry, and really encourage people to pay attention to them. And he brought in other students as part of a volunteer project in order to help with this. And they've managed to restore more than 1,000 missing children pictures at no cost, and provided these to family members so that they can put them on pictures, posters, T-shirts, and also give them to the police so that it can help the police with fresh leads. So it's been a very positive project. And so far, it's actually helped 9 children be found and brought back to their parents.
And the students that are running this project, have they thought about the future of how this could help more people?
Well, I think there's definitely a recognition now that because media are publicising their work, it will encourage the public to pay more attention. And also, there are many science and technology universities across the country, so it may also inspire others to follow suit. And similarly work with the police in order to raise more awareness. At the same time, though, there is, at the moment in China, there's a recognition that the AI technology is quite controversial, and especially using other people's images without their consent has triggered calls for more regulation. But with something like this, I've seen on social media platforms like Sina Weibo today, people commenting that with the development of AI technologies, this is something very positive. This is something that actually is a force for good. And people are saying that this is one way in which AI technology can really make a difference to people's lives.
That was Kerry Allen. Now, how often do you see a person with a disability on the cover of a top fashion magazine? It's very rare, isn't it? Well, the latest edition of British Vogue, it's trying to change that. It features 5 disabled cover stars and people with disabilities in numerous professions throughout the magazine. One of the cover pictures is of Sinead Burke, who was born with a form of dwarfism. She acted as a consultant on the issue, on everything from disability-friendly spaces for the shoots to organising editions available in Braille.
Not only did they take me on, but my entire disability-led, disability-majority team. And I'll never forget sitting in Vogue House and us sitting there talking about how do we meaningfully make a photo shoot accessible. The first thing we have to do is we have to ask better questions. And that's just a part of it. So for me, what makes this issue different is the way in which we think about visibility and representation so that it's not a moment, it is a movement.
I've been speaking to the magazine's editor, Edward Enefil, who also has hearing and vision impairments.
Every issue of Vogue is different, but the one thing that does tie it together is the idea of inclusion, diversity of perspectives. And I felt it was very important to shine a light on the disabled community and the incredible work they do, you know, in their individual fields. And I met my contributing editor, Sinead Burke, who's a disabled woman. She's a small person, who really educated me and my team about the smallest details, like in photo studios, the lack of access for, you know, disabled people at events, in retail spaces. So really, you know, it was a learning experience. And as somebody with invisible disability myself, you know, it just felt like, for these incredible people to navigate the world in such a manner that we will never know was just really worth dedicating a story to.
And to see people photographed as they are in this edition of Vogue, when the fashion industry as a whole seems to have a rather narrow perceived type of perfect beauty that needs to be seen, is quite unique, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, you know, I mean, the fashion industry does get a hard time. But I also know that sort of in the past, say, 7 years, I mean, ever since I started British Vogue, the conversation's changing about women's, you know, sizes, about, you know, who is the fashion model, what is beauty? You know, so these conversations are being had. And at British Vogue, you know, in every issue, we really shine a light on people, I always say, who are othered. People who are outside the norm, whether it's age, whether it's race, whether it's their religion, sexuality. And every month we try to profile people. It's not good enough just doing a one-off issue. So we're not doing a disability issue. You will see as we go on every month that representation is important.
Because skeptics and cynics might say, oh, well, this is just tokenistic.
No, it's not
more than that.
Oh, I know that. But for me, you know, as a person of colour, you know, I remember the days when they said, you know, black people can't sell covers. So you have to just keep getting your message through. You have to just keep, we have to keep educating that beauty comes in all shapes and sizes. And I don't stop, you know. Don't stop, won't stop.
So when you sit down at events with other editors of other fashion magazines, do you sense there's a change and people are moving in the same direction?
Yes, 100%. You know, I think the fashion industry gets a bit of a raw deal as being unfeeling, you know, very, I don't know, sort of lots of films out there. But there are people who care. There are people who want to see the industry change, want to move the industry forward. And the beauty of this issue, which came out yesterday, is looking on social media. So many people have invisible disabilities. So many people have relatives who are disabled. And I just want it to be easy to talk about it. I want people to be able to talk about it in offices. I mean, a lot of your colleagues will have invisible disabilities. And maybe now, you know, they can share it and not be shy about it.
That was Edward Ennifil. Thieves have made off with more than $22 million worth of gold and cash in a heist at Toronto International Airport. Police are at a bit of a loss as to who the culprits are and where the gold might be headed. However, they've also been rather reticent about the crime. Bola Mossaru spoke to the man who broke the story, Brian Lilly, a columnist for the Toronto Sun newspaper.
So it's banknotes as well as gold, and it arrived on Monday evening, Toronto time, in the early evening. The police wouldn't say where the flight was coming from, but they did say that it landed, and then they offloaded the cargo, went from the plane into a cargo-holding warehouse. Now, one air cargo shipping container filled with gold and banknotes that somehow slipped out, and I'm told it was, you know, just part of the shipment that came in. And so the value of that is $22 million of gold and banknotes. The police aren't saying how. My sources are saying there was inside help. But even that doesn't make sense to people that I've spoken with who work in this industry, who know this industry, who understand what normally goes into this sort of thing.
With that kind of shipment, you would expect security to be at an all-time high, an inside job or not. You wonder, are there not surveillance cameras? Are there not people posted everywhere just to kind of escort this kind of expensive cargo?
I mean, you would think, you know, they've been dealing with robberies for a long time. You know, the first gold robbery that we have on report at Toronto's International Airport was 1952. So they developed security methods, including armed guards, including surveillance cameras, and somehow they evaded this. One expert that I talked to in this sector said there are always armed guards, multiple. Why? Because if one's compromised, the other's not, or one's compromised and three others are not.
What are the police saying about this? Because as you've established, there has to be security. There should have been security. What are the police saying about how these people got away with it and who these thieves are?
They're saying very little. And if I hadn't broken the story this morning, this happened 4 days ago. You know, it happened on Monday. I reported it Thursday at noon, Toronto time. Heading into Friday now, they still wouldn't have said anything. You know, I've since, a memo was shared with me saying which bank and which airline were involved. And neither one of those companies wanted to speak. You know, we've named the bank and the airline at this point. TD Bank or Toronto Dominion Bank and Air Canada was the airline transporting the goods. They'd be pretty embarrassed. You don't want it to affect your share price. You don't want it to affect how people feel about, is their money safe?
Who are the police pointing their finger at? Are they saying anybody is suspected?
Well, I've had one source tell me that absolutely they're looking at organized crime. And then another said, that's ridiculous. Who would say such things? So, you know, even within the police, I'm not sure that they, you know, one side's talking to the other. But any port, you're talking airport or marine port, is targeted by organized crime. This is not unique to this airport in Toronto. It doesn't matter where you live, that's the case. Airport or water port, that's what happens. So, of course, they would have to look at organized crime. But quite frankly, they don't know at this point. You know, for this type of theft to happen, it would have to be somebody that had, as they say, cased the joint, knew what was happening, knew when it was happening, how it was happening, and how to get that. You know, we're not talking a small box. It wasn't a suitcase. We're talking about an air freight container that's at least 5 or 6 feet square.
Just out of curiosity, Brian, you said that, I mean, this happened on Monday, and as you say, you only broke the story on Thursday, which in itself raises eyebrows and questions. How did you find out about this, if they were keeping mum?
Well, as I've discovered in this business, people like to talk. Whether we're talking politics or police, somebody always wants to say, have you heard? And that's generally how good stories start. Have you heard?
That was Brian Lilly. In the last episode of this podcast, we told you about how the largest and most powerful rocket in history, built by Elon Musk's SpaceX company, had exploded on its maiden flight minutes after blastoff. American private companies have recently been taking a far greater role in space travel. But it was the Soviet Union that pioneered the industry by putting the first man in orbit back in the 1960s. In recent years, Russia's space program has lagged behind its competitors, but now the country's film industry has taken it to new heights. The first movie ever shot in space has been released across Russian cinemas, as Anna Aslam reports.
Lights, cameras, liftoff.
Вы готовы лететь в космос?
The Challenge tells the story of a surgeon who's sent to the International Space Station to save an injured astronaut. The trailer shows the main character moving through the cramped ISS with her blonde hair floating in zero gravity. And for the first time, it's not special effects at work. The lead actress, Yulia Peresild, and director, Klim Shipyanka, went through months of training before spending 12 days on the ISS, 400 kilometers above the Earth's surface. They filmed more than 30 hours of footage, including cameos from three Russian cosmonauts stationed there at the time. The movie has been lauded for helping Russia win the latest space race. The capsule that brought Peresild and Shipyanka back to Earth has been on display in central Moscow. And at a gala this month, President Putin hailed their achievement.
We are the first to have shot a feature film in orbit aboard a spacecraft. Once again, the first.
The Challenge took the number one spot after beating Hollywood's planned project in space, which Tom Cruise, NASA and Elon Musk are currently working on. Asif Siddiqui, a space historian, says the film's politics are more important than the art.
With incredible Hollywood movies such as Gravity and The Martian, the simulation of space is now so beautifully rendered in cinema now that one wonders, you know, the actual experience might be somewhat lacking. But I think it's not so much, it's not about what's being depicted on film that's important. It's the knowledge that it was filmed in outer space. I think that's more important to the audience that we, especially the Russian audience, who might feel a sense of perhaps pride at preempting those Westerners once again.
Well, The Challenge may be the first movie to be shot in space, but many more are expected to follow. Klim Shipyanka described making the film as an experiment, and it'll be interesting to see how future crews learn to work with the unfamiliar environment and deal with new problems. Shipyanka said it was particularly challenging, no pun intended, to film with a floating camera, while the light coming through the space station's porthole constantly changed, because the sun rose and set 16 times a day.
That was Anna Aslam. And that is the sound of some northern elephant seals, wide awake there and grunting away, as you can hear. But what about the way they sleep? It seems they do it hundreds of metres down in the oceans. Their sleep might be deep, but it's very short. Martha Carney got an explanation from Dr. Jessica Kendall Barr of the University of California, Santa Cruz, who was involved in the research on the seals' sleeping habits.
We found that when the seals started diving down, they would stop swimming and start to glide, and the signals in their brain would actually start to sync up, and that would create these large, slow waves in the brain. So that's the same as the slow wave sleep that you or I would go into every night, but these seals are going into slow wave sleep at around 100 meters under the ocean surface. And then they transition from slow wave sleep to REM sleep, again, just like you or I would in the middle of the night. But for them, when they transition to REM sleep, they're becoming paralyzed in order to not act out their dreams. But they're going to start this sleep spiral into the depth. And for the elephant seals, that takes them from about, 100 meters to up to 377 meters down below the ocean surface, at which point they wake up and they swim back to the surface. So each nap lasts somewhere between 5 to 10 minutes. That depends on the diving capacity of the animals. So as animals get larger and older, they're able to store more oxygen in their tissues and in their blood, and therefore their dive capacity gets greater. They can take longer naps underwater. So the adult female elephant seals, we found that they were sleeping about 10 minutes at a time, and that added up to no more than 2 hours a day in most cases.
I mean, that is astonishing to think that they can function on 2 hours a day. So how do they manage to survive?
I think when sleep scientists are interested in sleep and sleep deprivation and the impact that that could have on either humans or animals, we look at something called sleep rebound. So basically, we would look at once that sleep pressure that might be decreasing the amount of sleep available is lifted, what does the brain do to sort of re-equilibrate? So I think that there might be more of a case of these two modes of living where on land, they're sleeping a lot, and then at sea, they're able to sustain this low sleep for a very long period of time without incurring a significant sleep debt.
That was Jessica Kendall-Barr. We are off for our sleep spiral into the depths now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this one or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Harry Bly. It was mixed by Philip Bull. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.